This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Let me introduce the panelists. I'm going to keep the introductions very brief, and then obviously you'll hear more from them as we go on. Sitting next to me is Congressman Howard Berman, who served in the United States House of Representatives for 30 years, from 1983 until 2013, representing Southern California. Most relevant for tonight's discussion, from 2008 until 2011, he was chairman of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs and was one of Congress's leading experts on international relations. He was also a longtime member of the Judiciary Committee and was really very active in legislation related to intellectual property and copyright law, was one of Congress's most distinguished members for many years. Next to Congressman Berman is Gail Lamon, who is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and deputy director of the Council's Women and Foreign Policy Program. She's the author of a book which appeared on the New York Times bestseller list, and since I forgot to put it down, I'll give her a plug, The Dressmaker of Caracana. I bought it yesterday, and it's excellent, so I commend it to you. She writes frequently for Newsweek and the Daily Beast and other units as well. She was a longtime journalist. She worked for ABC News as political unit, and this week with George Stephanopoulos. And she specializes in writing and researching women entrepreneurs around the world. And then on the end is Corey Shockey, who is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. I just actually discovered on the way over here that she attended Stanford, but she's overcome that handicap very nicely, gone on to much better things.
Couldn't get into Cal.
Yeah. during the 2008 presidential election, Corey was a senior advisor to the McCain-Palin campaign on foreign and defense policy. Before that, she held a variety of positions in the Bush administration, including deputy director for policy planning in the State Department and positions on the National Security Council. She's taught at many universities, including West Point and Johns Hopkins, just to name two. So with that introduction, let's start talking. Obviously, people who have a lot of experience in foreign policy and know a lot about American foreign policy. So I guess where I want to begin with all three of you, and I'm going to tell you what I tell the panelists every year, which is please don't stand on ceremony. We want this to be an open, freewheeling discussion. So jump in when you want to. But I guess where I want to begin is the fact that it seems to me President Obama comes into office.
Not yet.
In the past, twice, and not yet. So President Obama comes into office promising, I think, in a way to be something different than President Bush was, and sort of to wind down, if we can call it this, the Bush Wars, to get out of Iraq, to implement a surge in Afghanistan designed to end that war, to pursue a more sort of tempered, less aggressive foreign policy. But in the years since, events, Libya, Syria, Iran, now Ukraine, have often produced calls for a more vigorous American foreign policy. And so there are those who, I think, praise President Obama for pursuing this sort of more tempered and restrained policy, and there are those who say he's just been irresolute in crisis. So I want to explore that a little bit. Gail, you've written about this a couple of times for Defense One and sort of explored these issues. So tease this out for us a little bit, this tension between people on the one hand who say he's been more restrained than President Bush, that's a good thing. On the other hand, there are those who say he just doesn't take action.
I think, first of all, it's such a pleasure to be here with all of you and also with this terrific panel. That was actually why I was very glad to do this. I'd never been to Berkeley before, so I'm very glad to be here. And this is a terrific panel, so thank you. I think it's a really interesting question. I'd done a story a while back, a piece. The Atlantic has this thing called Defense One, which is really looking at security issues of defense. And I was working on a piece for them and had some really interesting conversations with people who worked in the government who said, you know, at the beginning we were all very excited when President Obama came in, but the challenge is that I'm not Bush is not a foreign policy. And that was really from State Department people who really were very happy because a lot has been accomplished in terms of America's image in parts around the world where people thought that we had just gone too far. But I think there then becomes a point where even your allies say, well, what do you stand for? When do you take action? When do you mean what you say? And I have done a series of interviews recently with diplomats who I would not call partisan, nor would I call, you know, anything but sort of very engaged in America's role in the world, who are very worried. And who say they're worried about the shape of American leadership going forward. Now, that said, the president basically has the choice in almost every conflict between tuna casserole and fruitcake. You know, there's just a no good option. There's no good option in Syria.
I didn't get that at first. It took me a minute. Okay, anyway, go ahead.
I mean, there's just nothing that you really want to embrace, right? I mean, you know, is the Syria, there's a series of lousy options. Ukraine, there's very limited that you could actually do given where the country is. You know, there in sort of issue after issue, you have a really menu of fairly lousy paths you could take. And I think that that is really playing forward. And one last thing I want to say, which is that you can't talk about anything in terms of where American foreign policy is without talking about the wars of the last 12 years. Right? 1% of the fighting has done, 1% of the country has done 12 years of fighting in the name of this country, less than 1%. And yet the country is entirely exhausted when it comes to thinking about America's role in the world and anything that even resembles an intervention, whether that's military or even heavily diplomatic with military as a threat.
I want to explore this issue of whether or not, a bit later, whether or not voters would allow people to voters would tolerate a more active foreign policy. But I want to give the two of you the chance to jump in here on this sort of first question. Congressman, do you see a more restrained, wisely tempered foreign policy than the Bush years?
Without a question, it's a more restrained one.
Wisely so?
And more tempered, and in some cases, wiser, I think. I have a hard time speaking in huge terms. It's almost, let's talk about specific issues. And he obviously came in very much the critic of major elements of Bush foreign policy. A believer that multilateral is almost by definition in this post-Cold War world more effective than unilateral. Very reluctant to send U.S. forces anyplace. But in and of itself, I don't think that constitutes a foreign policy. But then let's take some specific issues. Let's take Iran, for example. George Bush called Iran one of the axis of evil. But in 8 years as president, George Bush never imposed a sanction that he had the authority to impose on Iran. When he left office, Iran was rising. America's position on Iran was pretty isolated. And in the course of, I think, a very effective display of commitment and a strategy for moving the ball forward to bring in an international support for a policy that would isolate Iran if it continued its nuclear weapons program, he did something that had not been done before. And the result of that, we don't know how it will turn out, and I could argue that will turn out well, or I could argue it will fail. But he has created at least a situation where one can see a diplomatic resolution that very well could say that we have effectively dealt with Iran's nuclear weapons capability and kept them from having it. It was a very careful priority of the administration, its diplomats, engaging with countries all around the world, friends and enemies. Even in the context of Tsar Putin's invasion of Crimea, the natural thing is, oh, the Russian reset, what a waste that was. But the fact is, people are forgetting some of the things we got from that Russian reset. Russia canceled its sale of S-300 weapons, air defense missiles that would have essentially meant that the military option would have been total rhetoric because Iran would have had the ability, the capability of defending against that kind of attack. They brought Russia into support of the Security Council resolutions, which became the basis for the kinds of sanctions that now has resulted in a significant change in the Iranian approach. We'll see if it means a significant change in the Iranian position. Time, a relatively short time, will tell. I would argue in this particular case, much more quietly, but quite focused, with a deep and serious commitment of time, he has approached this more effectively than the Bush administration did. Now,
let's let Corey get it. You were shaking your head already, so I don't know if you want to answer the broader question or Iran specifically, but take your pick, or both.
On the specific question, it is actually, in point of fact, true that the Bush administration did get an Iran sanctions passage through the UN Security Council.
No, my point is they had the ability to impose sanctions legislatively and never did it for 8 years.
One of the problems I think the Obama administration created for itself is this narrative that there are no good options on anything and math class is suddenly hard. But math class is actually always hard. The decision on Iraq in 2003 was hard. Do you allow a sanctions regime painstakingly constructed in which you had international support that was rapidly eroding? How do you manage that portfolio? That's actually legitimately a hard problem. A lot of people are rightly critical of the choice the Bush administration made. But I think one of the problems the Obama administration created for themselves was this notion that, you know, it's newly hard for us and it was easy for everybody else. And so they have talked themselves into a position in which there are never any, it's tuna casserole or fruitcake. But it's always tuna casserole or fruitcake, right? And they have, because they think about the problem, that's their conceptual framework, they don't think about incremental, intermediate things that can be done. And they also don't take responsibility for where inaction has both moral consequences, as in Syria, and practical consequences, as in Syria, which is this is a problem that's worsening with time as a function of our choices and a function of a lot of other things.
I have to say that the Obama administration policy on Syria is a glaring embarrassment in the context of where he's coming from, what he was trying to do, the constant shifting of positions, and I couldn't pretend to defend it. Whichever way you were going to go, he went each way.
We've got bipartisan agreement already. It's America. Anyway, go ahead. You were nodding that you agree that you think they, to some degree, did increase this sense of only bad options, that they have that sense more than previous administrations?
I think that, I'd say two things. In fairness to the Obama administration, I do think we are underestimating what 12 years of war has done to the American psyche and the American level of exhaustion, which then requires much more work if you're going to go out and sell an intervention, right? So that I do think that they are up against that. But I completely concur, and I do that with, you know, talking to very nonpartisan, you know, foreign service officers, folks that I've talked with for years, who say that, you know, what they worry about is that they can talk themselves into any position. And these were people who were particularly concerned about Syria. Not that they could take any viewpoint, but that they can see both sides of the argument, because they have so many smart people in the room that they can see both sides of the argument, which is a good thing. But then when it comes to the moment, and Ambassador Newman, who was ambassador to Afghanistan, said this recently, the recent ambassador to Iraq said the same thing, that they just, it's that moment of decision that has become a real challenge. And I think Syria, the issue for Syria is the cost of inaction. First of all, you have basically the equivalent of Cambridge, Massachusetts, or Burbank, California dead. Right? More than 100,000 people, we're now at about 150 and upward, the UN has stopped counting, are dead as a result of the conflict in Syria. Right? You have 2 million people displaced, 1 million of them are children, 3/4 of them are under the age of 12. If you think that that generation is not going to have ramifications for all of our security, we're wrong. And I think that cost of inaction is where Democrats have been very concerned. It is understandable, but I think it's problematic.
Was there a rational, let's stay on Syria for a minute, was there a rational course of action that the president could have taken that would have prevented that? Or was this just a sort of problem from hell, to use the Samantha Power phrase?
It's so easy after the fact to say, in a different situation, had you done certain things, this would not have happened. But having said that, I would have thought at the early days of that uprising, an uprising that was essentially peaceful and which Assad turned into a brutal military response, providing meaningful and concrete support and constraints on what the regime could have done to the beginning elements of that opposition could have changed the course of how this went. I'm not sure of that, but that was...
I agree with Congressman Berman. I also think that, especially in the aftermath of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the United States has a lot of... The Obama administration's right. The United States has a lot of work to do to rebuild how we look to the rest of the world. We look like simply our military power. We don't look like the blossoming of our civilian society, the civic groups and religious groups and all the sorts of small ball kind of engagement that actually are American foreign policy at its finest. But there was a lot that could be done on Syria. I personally favor an intervention that would have both rewarded neighboring countries, Turkey, Jordan, and others, Iraq, who had taken in refugees. And for a country like Jordan that is still dealing with the major political ramifications of having taken in Palestinian refugees in 1948, this casts a long shadow, and they've been actually doing quite noble, virtuous work. And an intervention on our part that was more like provide comfort in Iraq in 1991, that focused on refugees and making this tolerable for refugees and rewarding neighboring states and strengthening neighboring states against the threats that Assad's Syria posed and that the burgeoning civil war would push into their societies, could have eminently been done and would have been a useful starting point for engaging much more constructively in Syria than we have.
And would, a couple of you have mentioned the issue of kind of exhaustion. Would the American people have allowed President Obama to be more vigorous in that way?
Well, I think we should start with somebody who's actually faced American voters.
Well, I like what you proposed. I think the consequences on these countries, some of whom are close allies, of the Syrian refugee crisis is just enormous in terms of their own future stability. Mm-hmm. And in terms of Iraq, it's had consequences also.
Yeah.
I didn't hear my friends on the Republican side in the Congress pushing for increased funding to get that assistance to the settlement of those refugees. We reached a point when all that was occurring where essentially Congress didn't become part of a solution to resolve a problem, but became an obstacle. In and of itself, that's not enough of, because a president can propose and make the case. And in the end, if he can swing people to his side, he has the ability to get what he wants. But the environment in Washington is not as hostile as it is in Syria. But it's.
I agree with your judgment, but it does also seem to me that the president never did propose, right? And
that's
that right. My sense of American public attitudes is that we're always wary of foreign engagement. And if you read through the debates about NATO's founding in 1948, I mean, Congress wanted none of this, and understandably so. In truth, most of the wars the United States fights are wars of choice, not wars of requirement. And my mom and dad have to be persuaded that this merits the resources the country's going to put for it, and that the government has a plan that's going to be achievable by that. And one of the big damages that the Bush administration did to this, that the Obama administration and future generations, as Gail rightly says, are going to have to live with, is that this is a harder case to make after the wars of the last 13 years. But that doesn't mean you can't make the case. They just didn't make the case. And the public's not going to, my mom's not going to lean out there and take responsibility for doing this if the president doesn't have a program.
No, the people are not going to push the president to it. I take that case. I do think, though, there have been painstaking efforts in certain areas that need to be acknowledged, where they are spending their time and their energy trying to achieve something. And I do believe Iran is one of those cases. And
you're talking about, though, here you're talking less about efforts aimed at the American public and more aimed at diplomacy.
That's right.
Okay. But on this question of the public, you were looking like you wanted to sort of...
Yeah, well, on the issue of Syria, right? I mean, that was one thing where you could actually get a moment of partisan agreement. Right, you know, you talk to people who went up on the Hill to try to sell Syria policy. First of all, a lot of them didn't know what the actual policy was. But second of all, when they went up to sell when they finally did, they had this rare moment of unity where the right and the left both said, no thanks. We've seen this before. Not only did we not like Iraq, we actually didn't really like Libya. You didn't even come to us for Libya. And if you think you're going to get this money through, you know, or in our approval, come back and talk to us, answer our questions. We have more and more questions, which I actually think many people in this room would probably feel very good about that fact, right? I mean, it's not that that's a negative thing in itself. It's that their overall strategy has to be understood. And I think we live in a really noisy era, media-wise. And so getting that message out is very challenging. And it means that you do, you know, Jon Stewart, and it means you do Leno, and it means you do all kinds of things, sure. And you do a lot of online shows, you know, you do Yahoo chats, you do all kinds of discussions, and those are all important, but you still have to make the case. And I think that is where I do feel that there has been, on certain issues, a lack of getting out in front to make the case, knowing how uncomfortable it is going to be to sell that case to the American public, because this is a country that is absolutely... there's a recent CNN poll that 82% of the country no longer thinks Afghanistan was worth fighting. That's a huge...
Higher than Iraq ever was,
right. In part because it's gone on longer.
Right. When you said people who went to the Hill to sell Syria policy didn't know it, do you mean that they were confused, or that the president had never really decided what the policy was?
No, they were learning. Things were moving so quickly, right? Okay. Things were moving very quickly. There was definitely, once there was a decision to go to the Hill, there was definitely a sense of, here's what we need from Congress. But it had happened so quickly that people were really getting brought up to speed as they went.
Yeah, but the decision to go to the Hill came 24 hours after a decision not to go to the Hill. Right. This is within the executive branch's authority. This is...
And came 20 months into the Syrian civil war.
It was long after the problems of the composition of the rebels and the role of al-Qaeda and others in the rebel elements had muddied the waters.
And why, Congressman, put this, the president's in charge, let's tie it to the president very directly. Why do you think, you were an important figure in Washington for many years, why do you think the president failed, why was there this 24 hours one direction, 24 hours the other direction, why did he fail to set a specific policy and stick to it?
You could have several different interpretations. None of them are that attractive. One was, this was a great way of getting out of a red line that had been drawn that he didn't want to comply with, which is responding to the third or fourth of the chemical weapons attacks that had violated the red line he had set.
But then, of course, why draw it? He'd drawn it impetuously and just...
He's not impetuous as a general character. But my guess is it was a way of saying, I'm not going to, notwithstanding the tragedy we are watching in Syria, for a variety of reasons which I believe are solid, because I don't know how it's going to turn out, I don't know where it's going to end, I don't know what all the unforeseen consequences are. Iraq is a good story in unforeseen consequences. I'm not going to do that. But if they go so far as to use chemical weapons, which they're obligated, you know, international law, et cetera, I will respond. It was set up to, there is a point in which I will act, and that will be the point. And the point came, and you still had the unforeseen consequences and the negative aspects of it. And they didn't want to do it. And the Russians at that time and others were playing a very strong role in opposition to this. And in the end, I think what he's hoping will happen is chemical weapons will ultimately, hopefully by the final date set, be withdrawn from Syria, but that's not much consolation to the 150,000 who died, the millions who were refugees, and the worst of all are the ones who were refugees internally or so isolated inside Syria. So how did I get into talking about the one policy?
Well, we're going to move on from Syria, but Gail, did you want to say something else?
There's just one thing, and I want to bring this up because we have this room of all of you, which is, I mean, it has been very hard to stir the American people to recognize the scope and the scale and the horror of what is happening in Syria. And I think for a very empathetic people, we are just tired. And it's understandable, but it matters. It really does. You now have 1 in 4 people in Lebanon are a Syrian refugee. In Lebanon, half of the children are out of school. In Jordan, I think it's maybe 2/3 are in school. Uneducated children. Arne Duncan talks about this all the time. There is a direct correlation between lack of educational attainment and violence to come. This is something that really does matter. The world is watching in plain sight as children starve, as polio returns, and as people lose everything they have in any shot at hope.
Let's, on that dark note, let's move on from Syria slightly anyway. I want to go back to something, Corey, that you said earlier, that you thought that President Obama does deserve some credit for a change in the way the rest of the world looks at us. Mm-hmm. I think this is particularly true. I was looking at some polling data a couple days ago. This is particularly true with regard to Europeans, right? Less true people elsewhere around the world. If you ask them their impressions of the United States, you don't really get much of an increase. So the Obama argument, as I understand it, has always been by pursuing a more compatible tone with the rest of the world, especially Europeans, you'll actually increase American strength in the long run because you'll get the allies to go along with things that we want them to do. I'm curious to, you know, that's a response in some ways to your former boss. Do you think President Obama has improved our relationship, especially with Europeans? Is the argument valid that ultimately you actually increase American strength by doing that?
Yes and no.
Okay.
So yes to your first question, no to your second question.
Okay.
Yes,
so
Europeans are overjoyed to have the United States not leading with military force, right? Because that's their big criticism of American foreign policy. And it's a legitimate criticism. It's actually bad for our country that most of what the world sees of us is wearing military uniforms. It's bad for us that governance in Afghanistan is done by the American military and not by the State Department. It's bad for us that aid and development is seen being dispensed by military uniforms and not by earnest, well-meaning civilian and religious groups. It's not good for our country to have us perceived that way in the world. First of all, because it's not actually who we are. But also, it's not an effective strategy for doing what needs doing in the world. So the Obama administration is right in that regard. Where they are wrong, though, is that if you are going to move military force into a much more circumscribed role in American foreign policy, you actually, as Congressman Berman said, have to strengthen the non-military tools to do it. You actually have to build a State Department that's capable of doing the diplomatic functions that the military has had to do in negotiating politics, domestic politics in Iraq and Afghanistan. You actually have to build the capacity. The only department of the American government that has excelled at this, besides the Pentagon, is the Treasury Department. In the last 10 years, the American Treasury Department has brilliantly figured out who's counterfeiting money through what banks, what their links to governments are, how to track terrorist financing, how to focus sanctions on individuals. That's genius American foreign policy, and we ought actually to be incentivizing and practicing a lot more of that. The problem is that the Obama administration, in theory, likes that, but they're not actually doing nearly enough of it, and they're not strengthening the tools we need to do it. Granted the degree of difficulty in getting congressional support on this, but they're also not even asking for it.
And the Treasury Department, of course, this is one area where Obama had a continuation of the Bush policy. The people who were developing very effective strategies for confronting all kinds of problems, including Iran. In Treasury were maintained in the administration and are still there and playing a very major role.
Yeah, it's a great point.
And why hasn't the administration built up these other if your point was if you're gonna restrict the military power or not make military power the first thing that's front and center in the way the world views it, you have to build up sort of the other tools that one can use. Mm-hmm. Why hasn't that happened except for
Gil, that? You're incredibly knowledgeable on this. What's your
answer? I'm not No, I think the challenges of working with the Hill are dramatic right now. And I also think that, this is a time where the American public wants to be focusing on what the president said, nation building at home. The focus really has been it's wonderful to see all of you here tonight talking about foreign policy. But the truth is, if we were talking about domestic politics, it would be a whole other conversation. This is a point in time where I do think some of that is seen as an either or in terms of attention. As to the other parts, I think that they have done on Iran, and certainly in other areas they have really focused on some of this, but I can certainly understand where it hasn't been enough to people who want to see more. And I think, if you look at the wars we fought, it is true that the Pentagon has been better funded, has been certainly better equipped, and has been asked to do all kinds of things that the Pentagon does not usually get asked to do, nor does it want to do it in many ways. But that's not just the Obama administration.
I was going to say, do you mean that was true under President Bush?
Yeah,
or that's
sure.
Also true under President Obama? But
absolutely. And it's also a product of the wars we're fighting.
Another point I would make is that we have, for 13 years, had two administrations talking about the need for whole-of-government operations, right? You're not just going to have the military doing these things. The State Department should be responsible for governance. USAID should be responsible for building dams and highways. And yet, it keeps reverting into military responsibility because we haven't actually built the capacity in other institutions to do this. And so we keep building strategies that rely on abilities we don't have. And so it's not surprising they don't work.
Well, I argued a little differently because I spent a lot of time in my last few years in Congress focusing on how to rebuild capacity at USAID, create their own budgeting processes, getting effective missions that can provide input in terms of what programs we're funding and things like this. The problem is, in theory, you're absolutely right, but the dilemma has been in areas where you had your biggest security problems and needed those effective civilian programs, it was very hard to do without the military because they didn't have the security. I'm on the board of National Democratic Institute. The Taliban just killed a bunch of people, including one of the election observers in an attack. It's very hard to promote democracy, create economic development in many of these areas, unless you have a security presence, which is our military. So Yes, in all kinds of areas of Africa and India, in some parts of Pakistan, not many, in different areas of Latin America, I see USAID stepping up more. But in the conflict areas, it's really tough.
It is, and you see it on the ground, right? I mean, you know, there was this week a memorial service for Anne Smedinghoff, who was the member of the U.S. Foreign Service who was serving at the embassy in Kabul, who went out to deliver books in Afghanistan and was blown up, 25. And that was a year ago. So, you know, here was somebody who wanted to leave, who wanted to get out of the compound, and she paid with her life for her service to her country. So I think that all looms very large when you're asking people to do basic governance work in areas where there's an insurgency. These are not wars where it's, you know, here's my tank and here's your tank and then, you know, we'll meet somewhere in the middle, right? I mean, these are wars where you don't know where the next explosion is going to come from and where delivering books can turn deadly, right? Nobody's going to give you right of passage through that. It's just not in the way that the Taliban operates. And so what you have now is this also very perverse thing that certainly started well before the Obama administration of security contractors who get government dollars to get convoys through insurgent-held areas. And I think it was, I don't know if it's your committee or it was definitely on the House side that they brought up the people to say, why are we paying the Taliban to get USAID convoys through insurgent-held areas? And people would say, great, well, then how else would you like us to get through?
This vetting thing is a problem.
It's problematic in all sorts of ways. I mean, having private contractors carry out functions of lethal force is so morally problematic.
I agree with that.
And we are so deeply dependent.
There are more civilian contractors in Afghanistan than there are American soldiers, than there are coalition soldiers. The same was true in Iraq for the last several years there. That is a terrible set of choices we are making.
And part of it is because we lost the capacity within our state and USAID agencies to have the education experts and the water engineers who could do the projects and those kinds of people. They just got whittled and whittled down.
The decimation of foreign assistance funding in the 1990s, we are still paying the price for now.
Is this the problem of you know, you were talking, Congressman, about you can't really have USAID go out and do things in area without the military in areas where there is an ongoing security problem. And I'm just curious, this doesn't really relate, I guess, directly to President Obama, but I'm curious what all three of you think. I assume this is a problem that will probably only get worse, given that the world seems to be in a situation where there are a lot of non-state actors. These are not wars, as you said, where it's tank facing tank or something. Assuming that the world continues to be a world in which there are organizations, paramilitary groups, whatever, that are operating in very dangerous ways and want to do people harm, this is a problem that's only going to continue, right? That you're going to have a larger military presence to do this work going forward.
I actually don't agree with that frame of reference. It is not true that the world is getting more dangerous and more violent. It is actually not. More people live to older ages, and not just because of better health care, but because of declining violence all over the world. We have talked ourselves into a space where we believe that the world is newly dangerous as opposed to, you know, that long period of stability of the Cold War. And that because we see complexity, we equate that with increased threat. And I think that's actually a big mistake we're making as a country. The world's not a more dangerous place. It's actually more conducive to American interests than it has been in a long time.
Can I just say, I think in a way you're both right. You're right. You take in Africa, we think about Sudan and now South Sudan and the Congo, eastern part of the Congo, and some of the horrible things going on in parts of Nigeria and other areas. But there are country after country in Africa that are growing at a pretty good rate, where there's a level of governance that's gotten higher and higher in quality, where healthcare systems have become stronger and more institutionalized, not just for AIDS, but they've taken that funding and turned it into more effective healthcare systems. On the other side, I'll never forget a dinner I had when I mentioned it at lunch, but Larry Eagleburger was Secretary of State for the last year of George Herbert Walker Bush's, Bush 41's administration, because Baker went over to run the campaign. He was a better Secretary of State than he was a campaign manager. and Eagleburger said, "And Iron Curtain has fallen, the Soviet Union is disintegrating," and he said, "Mark my words, we're going to rue the good old days of the Cold War, where mutual assured destruction and the two superpowers tamped down so many different problems, obviously, like Vietnam, not all of them." And he says, "Now every ethnic, religious, national rivalry that has been tamped down for the whole period of the Cold War is going to start rising up in the most complicated and messy situation you could ever see." And we are living with some of that, particularly in the Middle East.
What did you mean, Corey, when you said a minute ago the world is more conducive to American interests than it's been in a long time? Did you just mean given the end of the Cold War, or what do you mean by that? Tease that out a little bit for me.
So I realize that Frank Fukuyama's thesis about, the end of history is unpopular. But his basic point was that there's no popular rival to free ideas, free markets, and free societies. And if you look across the time since the end of the Cold War, there was a time when it looked like political Islam would be an alternative, right? And not the hard-edged Al-Qaeda end of it, but the notion...
The Erdogan.
Yeah, the Erdogan version of it. So soft authoritarianism that's popular and that can win elections, but that wouldn't pass muster in Des Moines, Iowa, right? And in fact, what most people in the world want is what we take for granted. Like, people, when given the choice, actually do choose to have what we in the West want, which is opportunity, which is political freedom, which is a government that stays out of their religion and other things. And so Frank was right that we did actually win that great political victory. The only challenger that has, and most importantly, we actually won it in America, right? Like, during the Cold War, there were a lot of Americans who believed that the Soviet model actually produced more freedom than we have. Economic freedom, right? There was some.
I don't know, were there a lot, really? But anyway.
Are you talking about the 1930s?
No. And it's not just fellow travelers. Like, there were a lot of responsible, taxpaying, liberal Americans who had their doubts about...
That's just the conservative view of liberal Americans.
I have several in my own family whom I love dearly.
I don't think many liberals felt that the Soviet... that Joseph Stalin and the Soviet Union was something they wanted replicated here.
I see you the point. But there was debate in lots of places, right? What were we worried about in the 1950s? We were worried that the end of imperialism by Britain, France, the Netherlands, and other countries, that all of those societies would choose the Soviet model and not our own, right? That was the competition for the Third World. So we lacked confidence that our model was actually superior. And I think we don't lack that confidence anymore, right? The Chinese aren't choosing authoritarian capitalism. The Chinese government is desperate to figure out how they can create enough visible appearance of public satisfaction that they don't end up with their heads on pikes, right? They're in a race to produce prosperity in the hopes that once people have prosperity, they won't demand political change. But in fact, the arguments of every society that grows prosperous go the other direction. So what I mean is that actually the world's not that threatening. You don't have a end of colonization that is producing an anti-American or an anti-Western international order. You don't see a legitimate rival in economic and political senses. Most people want what we have, and we stand in the way of that a lot of times. But with our foreign policy makes us unappealing when our model should be more like that kind of stuff.
Right, right.
But in fact, most of the world is moving in a very positive direction, both for themselves and for us.
I mean, we were talking on the way over about Afghanistan. We saw that. You were just talking about Afghanistan.
The election in Afghanistan is a perfect example.
Yeah, and before we get to the election in Afghanistan, I mean, this is so, you talk about that. So in the Taliban years, I was in Afghanistan once, maybe in 07, 08, and somebody kept talking. I said, what'd you do during the Taliban years? And people kept saying, Teutonic. I had no idea what they were talking about. It's Titanic. But the movie Titanic had made a bigger impression on people living in the Taliban-era Afghanistan than I think it ever did in Los Angeles, California. Right? There was this sense that there was this world beyond, a world where there was no video, no music, no connection to the outside world, no work for women, no offices for women. That was bigger and sort of looked different, even though the world was not connected at that time. And so now you have an Afghanistan where there are enormous problems in Afghanistan, and you don't need me to walk you through them, right? Corruption, governance, security, and insurgency. And yet, you have this young generation that is just desperate for something better. I did a story for Fast Company magazine a year ago about Afghan tech startups. And could the Kabul Valley make a difference? And these kids would talk to me. You know, this story started as a joke, honestly, because I went to do a story. I went to interview entrepreneurs for some work I was doing. And this kid said, well, you know, we started the first chapter of the Association of Computer Machinists here in Afghanistan. I looked at her and I was sort of waiting for a laugh, and there was none. This kid had read about ACM online and written in his application, and this, so I tracked down the guy in New York and I said, when you got the application for the Kabul chapter, what was your reaction? And he said, I thought someone was pranking me. And they weren't, right? So then they showed me pictures of this Association of Computer Machinists first meeting in Kabul, right? Now, these are small starts. But there's no great change. It doesn't start except with small starts of young people, not always young, but often young, who are seeking something better. Now, they're facing a tide that is gigantic in a very tough neighborhood. So I'm not at all proposing something very rosy-colored about Afghanistan's future. But I think that narrative about what people want. You know, the book I wrote, there was a father who had been an army general for 30 or 40 years in Afghanistan, and his wife was illiterate. He had 11 children. His wife had 11 children. Nine. I say that as a mother of three. His wife had nine girls and two boys, and it was the father who made sure that every single one of those children got educated because he wanted them to contribute to their country. Now, when do you hear those stories? You know, as somebody who writes them, I can tell you it's awfully hard to break through and say, you know what? These people are out there. And not only are they out there in silent but great numbers, they risk their lives. And I think what Saturday in the election picture showed was that they were so tired of people talking about them and what they wanted that they were actually going to have a moment where they risked their lives to say who they were and what they wanted. And that's not always going to be things that America wants. It's just that there is a shared sense of value, which I think is often underestimated because we're so used to seeing people as other. And I think that actually really harms American foreign policy. And it, more importantly, it harms the way we frame stories to the American public so that we can bring along the public to have a healthy debate that's informed about where we want our foreign policy to be and what we want America's role in the world to be. And I think most of us are much more, now not in this room, but most of us are much more engaged about keeping up with our Kardashians than about what's going on in the Ukraine, right? I mean, and that's always going to be the case. you know, but I think there is a discussion to be had that is much more mainstream than we've had it about what America should look like and what America's role in the world should be that brings young people along, because it is technology that's changing so much of the discussion.
Let me suggest for members of the audience that if you have a question, please write it on a card, pass them down to the end of the aisle. Hopefully those of you on the end can hold them up, and there will be some people coming around collecting them, and then they'll be sorted and brought up to me.
Hopefully there will be people coming collecting.
There will be people who will collect them. But while you're doing that, let's go on to a couple other things. So I want to bring that, we were talking sort of generally about, I guess, America's role in the world. Let me bring this back to President Obama and his foreign policy, and let me do it in a provocative way. Corey, you wrote a piece for Politico entitled Obama the Narcissist, in which you wrote, the Obama administration's foreign policy is best characterized as narcissistic, not realist. What did you mean by that?
So the question that was posed to those of us who were responding to it was, is President Obama a realist? That is he a kind of hard-headed, classical, power politics, political operator? Is he Henry Kissinger? And I don't think he is, or I don't think he should be. I actually think American foreign policy is best served when our values are at the middle of our choices. That's both the way we motivate Americans to care about those issues and also about how we shape the world in our own interests. What I was getting at in the piece in Politico was that the president seems to believe that him talking about it makes it true. And I don't actually think that's succeeding very well. Whether
it
is
telling
Vladimir Putin what Russia's interests are, and therefore he shouldn't take Ukraine, it actually makes us look worse when Vladimir Putin takes Ukraine. And I think the president very often talks about policy. Well, the canonical example, the president saying superpowers don't bluff while he is bluffing about a red line in Syria. That kind of stuff, it's very much focused, this administration's policy is very much focused on the president as a transformative political actor. And that was the campaign rhetoric in 2008. And I think that is how they've conducted a fair amount of foreign policy. And I don't think it's a successful strategy.
Let's talk about Ukraine for a second, because this is an interesting, and I don't know the answer. My guess is, were George Bush still president, he would not have considered sending American troops to roll back.
I agree with that. I think the Georgia 2008 example
to say the least,
supports you.
To say the least. Obama's rhetoric, I mean, there were some funny phrases in there about explaining Russia's interests, although I thought there were also some very accurate statements about what's motivating Russia and what's Russia doing. Is he using this time, instead of, you know, huge all the time going after them and threatening them, laying a foundation for a consequence that if they go further, there will be the kind of broad base of support for that he can that communicate that to help deter that, or is he just whistling around? This guy is smart enough to think he needs a strategy here, and I think his natural inclination, and I think there's some logic that thinks sometimes quietly building up the tools to have that strategy is better than shouting about it early.
I agree with you, but those are not the only two options, right? And in fact, he did a lot too much public castigation of choices the Russians might have made. Think about Teddy Roosevelt's maxim about speaking softly and carrying a big stick, right? We're not going to wield a big stick. President Bush wouldn't have wielded a big stick there either. But that makes all of the public condemnation that the president was doing of Vladimir Putin much less likely to be effective. So I wish he were actually setting in place that conversation, but I have the sense that what might have been more effective would be to threaten the Russians in private And publicly, instead of talking about Vladimir Putin, talk about the German public, and talk about the French public, and talk about the Mexican public, the people who are actually going to join a coalition to impose those sanctions. Because that, you're not going to change Vladimir Putin's mind by trying to shame him in public. But you might shame the German business community, and that would be a really good thing. But that's not what the president's rhetoric was aimed at. I wish it had been.
He's talking to them privately.
I want to know your serious answer to that. I mean, do you think he is, in this case, doing a job of building a private coalition or network, whatever you want to say, building support for tougher action if that's needed in the future?
I always got to be careful between what I hope is happening and what is happening.
As do we all.
I have a lot of respect for him. I mean, I already told you what I thought of the Syria policy, and he's made other mistakes. His initial approach in dealing with the Israeli-Arab conflict in those first few months wasn't well thought out. And but this guy is pretty smart, and And he has some talented people around him, and I would like to think, and I have a day job now, so I don't have as much time to check on this stuff. I'd like to think they're trying to put together a strategy, which is going to show the Russians don't mess any further, because for a variety of different reasons, you will get hurt more by doing that than backing off.
I think that's right. I think that is what they are attempting to do. But I think there are a lot better ways to do it than having President Obama standing by himself at a lectern scolding Vladimir Putin. For example, having the Germans standing next to him, since they're the ones whose economy is going to be hurt so badly by sanctions, or designing sanctions that actually impose as much a penalty on us as they are going to impose on the allies we expect to carry them forward with us. There are a lot of little things that I think the administration should pay more attention to, and they are overinvested in the president as a riveting speaker on these issues and a public figure. And my point in the Politico article was that I don't actually see it delivering the results for the strategy that they are trying to implement.
It's just such an interesting tension, right? Because the reason why Obama was so effective at giving those speeches is because people wanted to hear something that wasn't President Bush, right? I mean, in the immediate after... No, I mean that actually seriously. In the immediate aftermath of 08, the problem is the what comes next question. And I think that is the question that, you know, I think I have this in my mind because I was working on this recently and talking to a lot of seasoned diplomats the congressman would know who were posing this question of, so what is next after this? You know, there is a sense, you know, and Secretary Kerry has talked about it, the president's talked about it, that in this century we don't do these things. And yet, that is exactly what the Russians are doing. Right, so you have this tension of where the world should be, where the world is, where the American public is, and I think drawing a triangle that works among those three constituencies has not yet been figured out.
And where the president is, presumably.
Absolutely.
What he is willing to do or not do.
Right, and I think that is in part a function of where he thinks that the public is also.
And I don't think we are quite at the stage where the possibility of a military response can be just every time discarded as, obviously I don't think it's here, but we haven't quite evolved to the integrated, globalized economy where the potential, when Netanyahu makes his comments about the interim deal, and part of it I don't like, but part of it, I like that blessing. I want Iran, and I want the Europeans, and I want the Chinese to think that is a possibility, because then they get more serious about discipline on the sanction strategy, because they think the consequences of that kind of an upheaval are so calamitous to them they get serious. So these things have two edges.
That's an excellent point. I do think the president has struggled to find a way to rule out military force as an option in his own mind and yet convey a policy in which the use of force would be integral to creating the effects you want in other people's
The forces. Afghan surge was not ruling out military force.
True, correct. I mean, he in that case, he used military force very vigorously. No?
I wouldn't go as far as either of those descriptions. Okay. I do think that the president judiciously understood that Afghanistan needed more force in 2008 as a result of the choices that came before if you were going to stabilize the political situation. I think the specific choices he made, namely surging forces and saying we will end this in 18 months irrespective of what happens in Afghanistan, actually badly diminished the likelihood of success for it, not least because Pakistan and Iran and other countries in the region understood that 18 months, we can wait it out.
Well, let me
and
ask
they
you,
have.
Let me ask you something, because in some sense I agree. Announcing your end date seems to have some great negative potential because people just wait it out. But what if in George Bush's mind, I got to have an effective strategy. I got to get this over with in 2 years. It took a devastating election, the sweeping out of the Republicans from control of both houses, to actually change the whole course of running the Iraq War. How much earlier might that have come if he didn't just think we'll go as long as we need to?
So I would love to have a panel on the many deficiencies of strategy in the Bush administration.
Okay.
I myself hold forth at great length upon them.
Okay.
But the fact that the Iraq war was unsuccessful doesn't actually mean the Afghan war had to be unsuccessful. And a set of choices that President Obama made about castigating the strategy for Iraq while applying it with a clock ticking in Afghanistan, I don't think set us or the Afghans up to be
but
successful.
Here's one problem on the Afghan war.
There's only one.
Well, here's the one problem I'm going to mention. The surge, the effort at trying to reconcile, all that loses some efficacy when the enemy can go and get sanctuary in the sovereign areas of Pakistan. And this is an element that both presidents have had to deal with, but particularly here, there was some security as a result of that surge in different parts of Afghanistan. There were people who were able to come back to their communities, live safer lives, and all this other stuff. But in the end of the day, when the forces are directed for somewhere else, which we can only touch through the drones, and where the Pakistan, our friends the Pakistanis, will not take on that enemy, creates a much more complicated problem.
I want Gail to talk about this because she's been in Afghanistan a lot. But I also want to ask this to lead into whatever you want to say. Has the Afghan war, I mean, couldn't you look at the Afghan surge, and particularly in light of this election, and who knows what's going to happen in Afghanistan, but couldn't you say that it's not been a failure, that it's been at least a pseudo-success?
So you could have made that argument as late as Friday and been the only one in the room making it.
Correct, right.
Right, I mean, so yes, you could have made that argument. There are lonely voices who would have said that you could have made that argument.
That's why he scheduled it for Monday.
What foresight?
I think the notes I sent you last week talked about leaving it behind a mess in Afghanistan. Yeah. And then after Friday, I sort of wondered, was that right? Anyway.
So I think, look, time will tell. There's, I think, three questions to be answered in Afghanistan. One is how the vote count goes. Two is whether there's a runoff and how that goes. And three, whether there is a peaceful transition to power. And I think we'll know the answer to that in the next several months, and that will determine it. A lot of what we see for the country going forward. I do, however, have one issue with this administration on Afghanistan in specific, which is that I think that they have basically serious, from a political standpoint, not a military, from a political and in part because of domestic politics standpoint, they have sort of dated Afghanistan for a long time without actually committing. And I think that if you look on paper, we are committed to Afghanistan through 2024. Ambassador Crocker and I have had some long conversations about a lot of this, and the problem is that on paper it's all there. But when you look at the real will to do it, I think that there is a huge question mark as to how serious the Americans are. I can tell you one story. I was in Afghanistan reporting, and I think the vice president was trying to work on an opening, perhaps as a Taliban, but said in an interview with Newsweek that the Taliban is not our enemy per se. And I cannot tell you what that set of interviews was like that day in Afghanistan, because people, and this was American military also, who I was around, and Atkins, and say, so why are you shooting at them? Right? I mean, so there has been this sort of ambivalence, and you see it on the troop levels, right? There are people like Ambassador Newman, there are people like Admiral Stavridis, neither of whom I would call, you know, partisans in this, who would like to see a sense of what, of an if-then. If the bilateral agreement is signed, then this is what American force levels would look like. That has not happened. I think Afghanistan went from the war we have to win pretty quickly to the war we have to get out of. And I think we haven't had a national conversation about why. I'm not even saying that my point is correct and that I think we should have a commitment there, because it's a very tough neighborhood that could actually be sort of a beach of stability with people who have a lot of shared values. But you can take the opposite side of that, and I've argued it to myself sort of to on occasion, but you have to have a conversation. How many of us actually feel like we are a country at war?
Can you win the war in Afghanistan if Pakistan doesn't want you to win the war?
It is an absolutely huge question. Now, it was interesting because General Allen made the argument today.
The policy should also answer the question of why doesn't Pakistan want us to win the war? And what is it about our choices that have made that so obdurate?
We win the war, that helps India.
That is one possible explanation, but the Pakistanis were the ones who had the strongest reaction to the 18-month timeline on Afghanistan, and to us playing footsies about commitment, that we are asking them to make an enormous set of choices.
No, they want us to be there, just not to win.
I don't think that's fair to them, actually. And here the Iraq parallel matters, right? Because Iraq in 2009 had enormously hopeful parliamentary elections. People were voting across sectarian lines, which they had not ever done before. They had a sense of hope and stability, and that the process was actually going to take them someplace good. And there, I think, our disengagement from Iraq actually did create polarization and fear, and that we permitted bad behavior by Prime Minister Maliki is actually casting a shadow into Afghan fears about what happens if we leave.
So the Iraqi foreign minister was in Afghanistan and said, sign the bilateral security agreement, Mr. Karzai. Take it from us. You want the Americans to stay around. Now, there have been all kinds of problems with that relationship. But maybe I'll just talk. Can I talk about something hopeful for a moment?
Yeah.
which is, you know, I did a piece 3 years ago now about Secretary Clinton and the role of women in U.S. foreign policy, and I know the Congressman knows as well. She pushed very hard and worked very hard to make a foreign policy that couldn't easily forget women. I know you say, how could half the population be forgotten so easily? But actually, it does happen pretty regularly in policy circles. And so I think that is something that has changed slowly, painfully, and it's not irreversible. But I think that has real benefits, certainly well beyond women, to economic development, to stability, to prosperity.
Child and that is health.
Yeah, to maternal health, to every development goal we have. And I think that that's not a small thing.
And it particular, and it had help in Pakistan. It empowered forces there to.
Yes, it was a real force for good in Pakistan.
Well, actually, I wasn't going to do one of the audience questions yet, but this leads perfectly into it. Could you President Obama has had two secretaries of state. Could you contrast Hillary Clinton and John Kerry's leadership style and results? So, does anybody want to compare Hillary Clinton? They're probably both friends of yours.
I'll take it.
Okay. You start, and then we'll...
So I think they have both been good secretaries of state, actually. I think they've both made similar mistakes, but on balance, here's what they've done well. They have actually been engaging presences for foreign leaders. They have tried to show America in its breadth, not just the sharp edge of its demands, which I think previous secretaries did too much. I think they have both taken an ardent interest in the Middle East peace process, which we might not care that much about, but governments in the Middle East keep coming to the United States and saying, it's harder for us to do what you want us to do because you're not making this a priority. And I think, like, whatever you think about the peace process, what you think about what all of our allies in the Middle East are telling us means this is worth putting some effort into. And I think they both have put considerable effort into it, sadly to no result, but they were right to make the effort. I think they are mistaken, both of them, in traveling too much. I think the mileage plus version.
You think Kerry travels
a lot? I think the mileage plus version of Secretary of State actually.
You like the Colin Powell style.
Isn't it helpful? Both of their voices are needed in the Washington policymaking thing. Secretary Clinton was herself essential in getting a better policy on Afghanistan than the administration would have had without her. I think they travel too much, and that's not the right metric. The second big criticism I make of both of them is that the State Department is a weak institution, badly run. It's an institution of incredibly talented people that, the American military is good at making a lot out of very little. They set people up to be successful. They educate them and train them and organize themselves that way. It would break your heart to see how little we actually invest in making American diplomats educated, assigned to their talents, and good at what they do. Secretary Clinton ran the first quadrennial diplomacy and development review, and it was a celebration of running a diplomacy and development review. And there has been no follow through on that except the creation of additional senior appointments in the State Department. This is an institution that actually needs managerial attention from the top, and both of them should be doing a lot more of that.
I definitely agree it needs more managerial attention. I doubt we will ever see a Secretary of State who is either the right person to provide that managerial capability or would want the job in order to do that. And I watched particularly, John Kerry became Secretary of State. I dealt with him all the time when he was Chairman of Senate Foreign Relations. But Hillary Clinton, two quite incredible things about her. The ability she had for the whole background and all the different reasons to move publics when she went to foreign countries and get to take the exchanges, to go and hear the hostile questions and answer them and handle them. And the excitement that she created when she traveled with the people, which I do think ends up having impacts on governments, even in less democratic countries. That was a tremendous strength. She was also an incredibly fast study. I mean, this is not somebody who went to the Foreign Service School and spoke 10 languages and all this other stuff. But she could really pick up an issue. I saw it in negotiating with her on legislation very quickly. I was spending a lot of time. For me, it was a major project. For her, it was one of 1,000 things she was dealing with. And very talented at all this other stuff. I got to take issue with one thing, though. I definitely want the Middle East peace process and for us to be playing a positive role, because I want it on its own terms to be settled. But the notion that the leaders of the other Arab countries, in their minds, prioritize the resolution of that, I think is just a pure smokescreen. And let me just make the case. George Mitchell came in with a special assignment, and he put lots of pressure on the Israeli government, freeze settlements, change your policy in a fundamental way, and I will get the Arab governments to take certain steps which will demonstrate their willingness, put meaning behind that notion, they're willing to work a broader comprehensive peace out with you. And he tried, he went to the Saudis, he went to these other, this is all before Arab, quote, Arab Spring, and he got nothing from anywhere. The notion that this, it's a scapegoat, it's an issue, it's an excuse. I don't think they care that much about the Palestinians. And to me, the issue deserves attention because it's a conflict that we need to resolve. And I say that for lots of reasons, but I feel it very strongly. I don't think it is what is keeping it solving other problems in that part of the region.
You just want to very quickly, and then I want to let Gail get in on Clinton and Kerry, but go ahead, respond.
I by no means would want to defend most of the governments of the Middle East against a charge of hypocrisy, especially where it comes to, you know, sort of whether they are doing what their public wants, since most of them are actually not representative governments. But I do think American foreign policy works better when we try and address the issues that people living in the neighborhood say they're worried about. And even if you don't make progress on Middle East peace for reasons that have to do with Palestinian governance, it still merits taking hammer to anvil because that will make it easier for us to get the King of Jordan to do what we want. And he's not a force for evil.
No.
And get the kind of cooperation from hesitant governments that are only half on our side on stuff. So going through the motions on that, I think, actually matters.
Well, so you're praising, because this administration's gone through a lot of motions.
Yeah. No,
okay.
I said it was the right thing to do.
I do, too. I agree. I just didn't think it was why that I disagreed with.
Well, I think, if you look, they're very different in terms of, you know, styles. And
You're back to Clinton and Kerry now.
That's a whole other story. But I think what's sort of related to that, you know, you would watch Secretary Clinton in action, and she would talk about suffocated opportunity. She would talk about young people, and she would be able to frame discussions in a way that would be hard to disagree with. And I think that there was a political awareness of her celebrity, which we will very rarely see again, right? There are just, you know, a handful of people in all the world who have that name recognition. And I think you can take issue with some of her managerial style, but there were people in the Foreign Service officers who would talk about how it was a better run State Department than they had had in recent memory because they knew what the priorities were and they did understand where it was. I don't think that that is the case now. I think I have heard a difference, and I think it's in part because of the airplanes. It's in part because, you know, so many trips. It's in part because it's a very complicated set of conflicts right now that are brewing, and I think the Arab Spring, certainly, or Arab uprisings, however you want to call them, have definitely made the constellation of issues in the region both thornier, more time-consuming, and far more complicated than I think they were in the early years of the Obama administration. But what she did successfully, which I think was really smart in a Washington that barely paid attention, was to go over the heads of fancy people and to try to connect to people in streets, in rooms like this, to students, and to make something recognizable of an American public, of people who rarely have contact, right, with that. And she understood that we were living in a very different era. Now, hard power still matters most. We haven't replaced that. But in terms of what is shaping the dynamics of the world that we live in, young people, youth unemployment, technology, media, all of those things she understood really mattered. And I think she did change to some extent the time that a secretary would put to some of those. And, you know, I think it's hard to go after her, whomever you are, right? We would talk about this when we were working on interviews during that story, was, you know, no one will have that profile. I don't care, Republican, Democrat, you know, unless Bono becomes the Secretary of State. I just think,
awesome.
You know, there is a rock stardom that helps when you travel the world that she had. And particularly on the women thing, she really shone a light into places that people did not want to see.
Let me ask a question from the audience that changes us completely to a different area, but one we haven't talked about. The Obama administration's pivot to Asia now seems to be undermined by a series of events in other regions. What do the panelists think about the future of Obama's foreign policy toward Asia in facing the rise of China and North Korea's nuclear weapons project? Anybody want to talk about the rise of China as a global power and or North Korea and non-proliferation?
Haven't I been talking too much?
No.
It's walk and chew gum at the same time. The president has to be able to do that. In a weird way, we have an open door waiting for us in Asia. China has created that, in a sense, by taking actions that are a little more aggressive and assertive than they have in the past. So that countries in Southeast Asia and all around China are much more interested in the U.S. presence than they ever were during the time of the Cold War, even in the years after the Cold War. So fundamentally, the president sees that opportunity, and it isn't to be confrontational with China for the sake of confrontation, but it's to make the Chinese think twice about how far they're going to go in any particular area. And he's going back to Asia now. There's real tensions there now, and I don't want to overstate what can happen, but when you have these kinds of disputes getting more open and you have a pretty tough-minded president of South Korea and a pretty hard-line leader of Japan, and you could see we need to be involved to help bring some sanity, perspective, and the notion that we are still there, that our obligations mean something even as we try to work with China.
I agree with Congressman Berman completely. I think it was a mistake on the administration's part to talk about a pivot to Asia, and that's explicitly the White House's term. Everybody in the Pentagon and State Department kept trying to say, no, we're just going to rebalance slightly, do a little bit more in Asia, because that's where the nature of the biggest challenges
are. We put 200 more forces into Australia.
2,500 Marines are a frightening sight, I'm agreeing. But the mistake that they made, first of all, announcing that, because if you pivot, you're pivoting away from something. And
away from war, so I mean, right? I mean,
but also sort of Europeans think he's pivoting away from Europe, and Jordanians think he's pivoting away from Jordan, and Mexicans think he's pivoting away from NAFTA. Right. So the joke is that the only people who don't think we're pivoting to Asia are Asians. And in fact, you made the point earlier about how much more popular the Obama administration is in Europe and several other places. The region in the world that is most nostalgic for the Bush administration is Asia, because they did actually like the sharp edge confrontational policy. Most of our allies in the region felt much more comfortable with that as a means of managing China. And so it's problematic both in terms of the reaction of countries outside of Asia and in terms of managing the reaction of allies and adversaries in Asia. I think it was a bad choice.
I think one thing we haven't talked about tonight, which I'm amazed, is we haven't even really talked about drones. Mm-hmm. We haven't even talked about sort of the changing nature of American warfare, I think maybe for next time. But I think there are so many dynamics going on that are not talked about enough that I think the Asia pivot was talked about a lot. And then, you know, we were all sort of waiting to see what followed. And so I think you have this sort of interesting tension between things that are happening and aren't being talked about, and things that are happening but less, they're being talked about a great deal. And I think we're going to keep having that tension, and we're going to keep seeing that play out, in part because some things are easier to talk about than others.
And the expansion of executive authority. I mean, it's all 9/11 started some of this. When you authorize the use of force for a war that never ends, and which originally is targeted at an enemy, al-Qaeda, and the people who have given the support to Taliban, and then morphs into Somalia and Yemen and the Maghreb and who knows where, and starts a lot. You know, at what point is the constitutional balance? I'm a great believer in strong executive power, and particularly in foreign policy. Maybe it's because I worked in Congress, but I, that part scares me. But there are limits and there are constraints, and Congress should be trying to revisit this issue of the authorization of the use of force and when and where, if nothing else, for just the pride of their own institution.
I do think that the biggest foreign policy mistake the Bush administration made was not seeking public and congressional support for what they believed was essential in executive power in managing the threats the country was making. For all the reasons that are about not just constitutional division of powers, but about building a broad public support for what you believe is necessary for the defense of the country.
You mean like enhanced interrogation techniques or whatever?
Opting out of those debates, you actually have to win the argument. And shying away from the argument has been too much done by both the Obama and the Bush administration on these issues, that we shouldn't be forced into a discussion about surveillance. We actually ought to make conscious choices about where we as a public feel comfortable setting those boundaries and the risks we're going to take depending on where we set them.
And these are issues, I mean, we don't have a whole lot more time, but these are some of these issues, like surveillance and drones and so forth. There are many people who've said Obama is not that different than President Bush.
It,
and in many respects, is right. If anything, is right. Expanded the use of drones.
Oh, it's expanded. I mean, you can have whatever views you want to have about this war, and I'm working on a book that has to do right now with the special operations community, and I have enormous respect for it, and I actually don't think we have reckoned with what we have asked America's fighting men and women to do over 12 years of war. Most of us don't want to think about it, we don't want to know it, and when they are sleepless at night, we're not there with them. When they're injured at Walter Reed, we're not there with them. I'm not arguing for not being in war, and I'm actually certainly not making an argument against engaging in war, but I think we have to reckon with what we ask of our countrymen and women who are serving. But I think that this discussion about what is it that is authorized in the American public's name is one we have to have.
And to the degree that the Obama and Bush administrations have some similarities here, I mean, Corey, do you sometimes feel slightly vindicated that President Obama, very critical of President Bush, has in some ways continued some of his policies?
No, I actually wish he would make a very strong public case for those he believes need defending, and I wish he would actually change policies that he doesn't. I really think that we are...
This goes back to wanting to win the argument.
I mean, we actually need to have these conversations. This should not have taken the Snowden revelations to force a discussion about what is appropriate surveillance going on in our name that the president... is choosing. So no, I don't feel vindicated. I wish he'd done a lot better.
Thank you all for coming. Please join me in thanking the panel.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.